Episode 25 of Season 17, Typos Force Arbitration of Big O Notation.
AT&T thinks arbitration is awesome. Lyle can't keep up with the latest Comcast bandwidth. Nielsen's ratings get gamed. The sharing economy doesn't give back umbrellas. OpenBSD shows the way forward, and the geeks put the O into Big O.
Hello, I'm Lyle Troxell, and welcome to Geek Speak. With me in the air room is Miles Elam. He's a pedant, a curmudgeon, and an amazing programmer and father. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
Also in the air room is Brian Young, and Brian Young is a programmer and a marketeer and a maker and a father. And hi, Brian.
Hey, Lyle. How you doing?
Good to see you. Miles, tell us about AT&T and arbitration.
To avoid going to the courts, you know, because you would have issues with your provider, in this case your telephone provider, AT&T. Having to go to courts, having to go through that process tends to be very expensive for everyone involved, tends to take a while. And so one of the things you do when you sign up for AT&T service is that you go into a binding arbitration clause.
This is kind of common, isn't it?
It is, to say that no matter what happens, you don't sue AT&T. You actually go through an arbitration, and they resolve the dispute.
And the consumer argument for this is that it's faster than going through the courts, and it relieves the court system of these.
That would be the idea, yeah. Arbitration almost always goes in favor of the company that has requested arbitration.
Really? Why?
Logically,
it seems pretty smart. I feel like when I just was purchasing my house, there was an arbitration clause with one of the vendors I was dealing with. So it seems like it's a kind of standard thing. And at some level, it makes sense to try to be rational first through arbitration. And if it doesn't come to a conclusion, you can then go to court.
The way I like to think of arbitration is very much like the HR department at a company.
Oh.
The idea being that there is some conflict that has arisen, so you need to find some way to resolve it, figure out some way to referee. The thing is, though, that a lot of people don't recognize is that arbitration is being paid for, contracted by the company itself, just as HR is an arm of the company itself.
So the arbitrator's self-interest to keep the client is to keep the client happy.
Yes. Just as HR exists to protect the company, not to protect the employee. It's so that the company is able to show that it did its due diligence to make people's lives not miserable.
So if you were about to sign up for AT&T for some reason, like let's say you wanted to get DSL at your home, and so you had to go sign up with them, you would just, because you know arbitration's for them and not for you, you would just decline that and not do arbitration.
Except you can't do that. AT&T says you either get arbitration or you don't use our service. And people have taken them to court to say, hey, this is not fair. This is obviously the deck is stacked against me. Mm-hmm. So I don't saying that they don't believe that forced arbitration is legitimate. AT&T has countered by saying that their forced arbitration isn't actually forced because no one has to buy their service.
let's take for a second as read that potentially you could get different service. It still feels like I see the argument there.
Well, this is the argument about how Google is not a monopoly because you can use other search engines and so on. Isn't the same argument?
Now, this dovetails in with the next story, so I'm just going to mush them together, which is that
– Wait, you didn't answer the question though. You didn't answer your own question. Do you feel that it's appropriate for a company to say, hey, if you want to do business with us, these are the rules we do business with?
This is where the answer has to be based upon what are the person's choices otherwise. This is why I wanted to roll into that other story,
which is
50 million U.S. homes – only have one 25 megabit per second provider or they have none at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, 10.6 million homes, no wired access to 25 megabits per second. 4.9 million can't get 3 megabits per second. In the U.S., it is quite common to have one
broadband provider.
Yeah, if you have that. So for then AT&T to say, as this nationwide provider, that no one has to buy our service, if they're the only provider in an area, the choice is go with this somewhat coercive contract,
yeah,
or go without internet altogether, which is less and less possible in our connected society.
I guess I don't understand another aspect of this. If I go to my mechanic and I say, hey, please fix my car, and they say, yeah, I'll fix your car, here's the contract we've got, this is my bid, and by the way, make sure to sign this bottom thing that says if I destroy your car, I'm not responsible. And then due to negligence, that night their entire garage burns down because they disabled their smart alarm systems and they left a can of oily rags.
That seems rather extreme as an analogy.
I'm just saying that even though I signed that contract that said I'm not going to hold them liable, they are definitely liable for my car. And that little signature in that contract is not going to do anything to the insurance company claiming money off that company in my benefit. So it doesn't – at some level, those little disclaimers – are fightable and are dismissed. You know, you can dismiss them at some level because you can't just say, hey, no matter what I do, nothing's wrong, you know, stab you in the neck. I mean, there's some things that are wrong.
They're not saying that nothing is wrong. And this is not to say that arbitration always goes against the customer. That's not the case. And it does cut down on the number of people that will just frivolously put forth a suit because when you're going to arbitration, things tend to be fairly severe in terms of, yeah, that's not an issue. Goodbye.
Right.
Much more so than in the actual courts.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that this is because it's not possible for people to get broadband without AT&T because they live in certain areas? One response to that is, well, just move. Then you can get a different service provider. But in any case, that argument you're saying, because of that, people are kind of forced into getting this service.
Yes. I find it to be personally, I find it to be coercive. If you live in a market that has multiple providers, that argument has a lot more credence.
Sure. So let me ask you this. For a person who's in a area that only has AT&T as the service, it's the only phone line at the house, there's no cable, and maybe there's a lot of trees, so it's not possible to get satellite service or something like that. And they've signed this, and AT&T has done them wrong. Will the court dismiss the arbitration ruling, and will the court listen to a complaint? Meaning, is this admissible because of this problem?
If there is a criminal violation, yes, you can go to the courts. There's nothing – there's no contract you can go into that will nullify a criminal complaint such as fraud. But at the same time, if this is merely a contract breakage, you're in contract law – that's civil court, and that's where the arbitration comes into play. That's where you're saying I waive my ability to go into a civil court to deal with these issues.
Right.
And that's where it comes into. Let's say that you are out someplace where you only have this provider and your business depends upon connectivity, and – then you consistently get dropouts or, you know, loss of connectivity in peak times that your business depends upon, then you would have to go to arbitration and have to figure out a way that was equitable. But, you know, how – there is a question as to how much restitution you're going to get in that scenario when the deck is stacked against you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even if that arbitrator is trying to be you know, impartial, that doesn't say anything about, you know, human beings. When your livelihood depends upon something, your brain tends to be a bit more malleable as to what is acceptable and what isn't. That's just a human condition.
I just wanted to underscore something there, because you rushed through those numbers of how many U.S. households are limited to 25 megabits and below. You said how many?
50 million U.S. homes.
I just looked up. That's out of 125 million. So that's what, 40%?
Yeah, in the 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a staggering number.
Let's talk about another carrier provider, Comcast, which is the high-speed data access that we all have access to in the San Lorenzo Valley and of Santa Cruz Mountains. And I've been a customer for them begrudgingly for quite a while, as have we all. And I just the other day at the new house was deciding that last night I was making a decision that I should probably stop paying for this larger package because I'm not sharing my internet with other people. Yeah, I was, by the way, doing that illegally or out of contract with them. Don't tell anybody. And so I was going just to my own family, and we don't use as much bandwidth, so I went ahead and went to look at a cheaper rate. And I went up there, and it turns out that in our area they have 200 megabit per second blast data, which is pretty impressive data coverage. So I'm like, oh, cool. I'll switch my service. Oh, and it was cheaper. It was a lot cheaper. And so I switched over to that. And right away it started working, which was unlike that. I actually was able to buy something they told me I could buy online with them. Normally you try to do that and they say, no, we don't have that in the we don't have this service for you. Really frustrating. But in any case, this time it worked.
Welcome to a new tax bracket.
No, it was actually, I mean, it's cheaper than it was before. I mean, it's, any case, so I got the bandwidth. It seemed like my modem had a problem. The modem that is actually leased by them for $10 a month had a problem for a few minutes as it kind of reset. And then I did my speed check, which I use fast.com, which is a service by Netflix, the company I work for. And I got 240 megabits per second down, which felt really exciting and happy, and that was awesome. The same thing I was doing last night, though, was getting rid of this lease because I have my own modem that I bought a long time ago, and the modem that I bought was like $100. And instead of spending $10 a month, I own it.
Sure.
Right. So I look up the model, and I find out that it only can do 174 megabits per second down. So now I've got to choose to downgrade my performance of my home speed. And I went ahead and just did the practical thing, and I pulled out their router modem and I switched to a lower speed to save me, I don't know, $10 a month.
So how long will it be before you spend $125 to get a new modem?
I priced it. I looked at it. It is about that much money. I don't know. I don't think I'm going to do it. I mean, it's a lot faster than I was getting before. I was getting 100 megabit before, and now I'm getting like up to 170 or something like that. So,
right. It's that age-old question, is the glass half full or half empty? You ask the engineer and say it's twice as big as you need.
Yes. So the other aspect of this was I then am like, because the modem, of course, is not a Wi-Fi access point, I actually have these great Wi-Fi access points. I like a lot. They're made by this company called Unify. Ubiquiti,
yeah.
Wi-Fi. And there's these router points that I got when you moved off the property that we used to share because I still wanted to have broad range. And so I brought these outdoor antenna waterproof things that were kind of pricey at the time. But I thought, well, this is helping my neighborhood and you know, I'm sharing the network and all that. And so I bought these things. Unfortunately, because I bought them 3 years ago, they don't do the top speed. They can't do 100 megabit. And so now I've got to decide if I'm going to spend all this money to even get up to the speed that my computer can actually handle and my data bandwidth to handle.
Think of it this way. At least you'll have another network you can set up for your IoT devices so you can have it separated.
That's right. I'll be able to use them and just have all these things on at the same time. So I was looking at the Ubiquiti, the Unify stuff. I keep on saying Ubiquiti, but
Ubiquiti is the company.
X. Yeah, Ubiquiti is a company. That's right. Okay. And actually, we talked about the Router X, from the same company.
Edge Router X.
The new access points that they've got are doing 1,300 megabits per second, which is crazy.
That's on the low end of what AC routers can do
these
days.
But this is a $100 router.
This is the light version?
Yeah, the light version. Yeah. The light version actually is at 868.
Okay, that's what I'm running.
Yeah. Oh, you are? You run one of those?
I have two of those.
You do? So you totally covers your home?
My two buildings, yes.
That is awesome.
Now, let's be clear here. When you see those ratings on wireless routers, you are never going to see those numbers.
You get what, about half of that?
Have you done a fast
if
through them?
If that.
I have not done tests lately. One of them is actually running on across an Ethernet cable that is
questionable at best.
Yeah, it's usually dropping back to 100 megabits.
But yeah. The speeds up. Your whole property is covered by two of these.
Yes,
that's pretty cool.
Right. So if you have one of these routers that says that they're 1300 or 1800 or 1900, if they are the perfect distance with no walls in between, you're still probably going to get, 75% or lower in terms of that number in terms of actual bandwidth.
Actually, no, I remember now. It just came back to me. I remember seeing about 400 to 500 megabits per second on the one router or on the one access point.
Do you have like a NAS on one side and your stuff on the other side and they transfer data? How do you get that much throughput?
Well, this is reported by the access point itself.
Oh, okay.
So it's not like I was doing an independent test.
You should do some file transfers and see.
I need to.
Yeah. Miles, tell us about TV networks.
You ever watched a favorite show and like you go through and you're like, oh, this is entertaining. And then a show, an episode comes up that is a true stinker. I mean, you're thinking
– of the same show?
Yeah. You're thinking, wow, that was just a low point. I'm thinking
– like what kind of shows are you talking about?
Well, think of the original Star Trek series.
Okay.
There were some really amazing
episodes. I only remember the good ones. Can you remind me of a bad one?
Spock's brain.
Okay. Yeah,
it was a conspicuously bad episode.
Sure.
Well, the same thing happens today. You have good episodes, you have bad episodes. What something has found is that TV networks for a while, whenever they had to deal with Nielsen ratings, for example, if they had an episode or some show that had conspicuously bad ratings, when they reported the show – you know, or registered the show with the Nielsen automated system, they would introduce a typo to the name of the show. Yeah, in the title. Nielsen couldn't handle that this was actually just a typo and refer it back to what it actually was. So that meant that this outlier, this thing that was bad, is just now constrained to its one-off status, a show that happened only once.
Meaning that it looks like a single movie that has bad ratings and doesn't draw down the entire show's ratings.
Exactly.
It's so clever.
Now, the Nielsen ratings, that's only done at, or at least it was only done at certain windows of time? Or is this running all the time with a new modern system?
This is something that's run all the time. So instead of like the NBC Nightly News, N-I-G-H-T-L-Y, you do N-I-T-E-L-Y, that type of thing.
Leave the S off of Miles.
World News Tonight, you know, take away an O.
How was this discovered?
I actually don't know how it was discovered. Nielsen has issued a statement that it was displeased with the state of affairs. Yeah.
It's funny. You'd think that they would just figure this out from the whole perspective of having a whole bunch of floating single episodes of things.
Well, isn't that the difference between a technology company that gets into a business or a business that gets into technology?
Totally now, true. They might have just handled it really bad.
I can say that, for example, on GeekSpeak, there are a non-trivial number of shows that have some typos in them.
That's not for rating purposes.
Right, exactly. But it happens because some people just don't know how to spell.
Are you talking about me?
Hey, I just said some people. You didn't need to bring it about you.
You and I are the only ones that do the old shows. All right, go on.
So
Spock's Brain, by the way, is season 3, episode 1, and it's on Netflix in the U.S., so you can go watch it. And I remember it being really greatly bad, so I highly recommend it.
Brain, what is Brain?
I'll link to it in the show page today.
It obviously scarred Miles.
Now, so typos happen. What they were finding, because typos always happen even when they're not trying to game a system. You know, I haven't worked at a company yet where the executives all spoke and wrote and communicated with perfect grammar. It just hasn't happened, grammar and spelling. But this was something where they noticed a definite trend of, hey, this one had conspicuously low ratings. Maybe it was going opposite
of
a very popular thing. Like maybe you have a news program going at the same time as the Super Bowl, you know, that conspicuously the misspellings seem to be clustered.
Interesting. It's cool. Hey, Brian, it's your turn. Let's talk about umbrella sharing.
It is the sharing economy. There's what? Uber and Lyft. There's what do we have for sharing our homes? We have Airbnb. Well, over in China, they have their whole collection of companies as well, and they've gotten into the sharing economy in a big way. But You know, not every business is designed to be shared, share resources in the same way. And China is known for having a lot of businesses spring up, and this one might not have been the best idea. Can I introduce you to umbrella sharing?
What does it mean?
Well, there's many rainy days that you might not bring out an umbrella, and this company is there to help you. They want to provide you with the chance to share an umbrella. Now, what would you think would be the main problem with a business like this? I mean, bike sharing has taken off in China in a big way.
I was actually thinking the Dutch, when they started bike sharing, they had a big problem with theft. So
yeah. So this company called Sharing eUmbrella has this problem where it's only been in operation for a few weeks, and already their 300,000 umbrellas have gone mysteriously missing. Apparently, in their business model, they didn't actually account for the fact that not only do you have to take the umbrella, use the umbrella, but the umbrella is going to end up back in the person's house most likely, because that's one of the obvious places they might be going. Unfortunately, they didn't do enough to encourage them to bring the umbrella back.
How much was the surface?
The surface is 19... Oh, help me say this.
Yen? Won?
Won.
Okay.
So 19 won.
I have no idea what that means.
For a deposit. 50 won for a half an hour of use. And it is a 60 won item to replace. So the markup on this is really wonderful. I can see why a Chinese business would think this would be a fantastic business to get into. Unfortunately, it's still not working out.
It seems like you just have a larger deposit that you lose or something. It seems like there's a way to manage this the correct way. But the thing I don't get is that – is an umbrella really – like leasing an umbrella, is that really worth it? It seems like I've got – like bought an umbrella and had it for years and years.
Now, bear in mind, we live in an area where California is odd that you usually have about 2 days of notice before it starts raining. The cloud starts to darken, then it gets really dark, and then you have a day or three of rain, and then it's dark but not really raining.
But never 4 days because it's California.
And we're not exactly walking between business and home.
We're driving a lot.
Right.
So, but most places, it's a bright sunny day, and then
– why do you say most places?
I would say most places in the world that aren't arid deserts, that the storms will come out of nowhere. Like it'll be a bright sunny day and 20 minutes later it'll be raining.
I don't think that's most places, but I get what you're saying. There's a lot of places that
says the person who's lived in California for how much of your life?
I've traveled other places. Thank you very much.
In the summer.
Brian, Mr. I've lived someplace other than California. Is this the case?
Oh, yeah.
He's from Virginia. That doesn't count.
Yeah. Summer storms come up out of nowhere.
I'm sorry.
Virginia doesn't count?
What I'm saying is you just picked a location that has frequent thunderstorms.
All right.
Like the South is just like that.
Pick a state.
Texas.
Has thunderstorms. That's also in the South, by the way.
Yes. But it's not
Ohio.
But it's not at the same level of just like
Illinois?
Automatically coming on. You get to know about it beforehand.
You don't.
I guess what I'm saying is, how do you know that most places on the planet are like this?
Because I've traveled.
So California is not like this, but most places are. What makes California different?
The Pacific Ocean is a
stabilizer.
Yes.
Is the Atlantic?
No, it's
a destabilizer.
On the east side of the Atlantic, is it a stabilizer?
The thing is, the way the ocean currents work, we get water from the Arctic, so cold air coming down.
Stabilizers.
Which is reducing the amount of energy that builds up. That's why we don't have hurricanes coming on the West Coast.
If you'd like to argue with Miles, I welcome you to email us. Our email address is geeks@geekspeak.org.
Honestly, now I just want to ask one last question. Have you never heard the term, don't like the weather? Just wait 20 minutes. You've never heard that saying
before? Yeah, but I thought that was regional. I think that was global. You're saying that's global. I don't think of that as global. I think of that as regional.
I think that is a lot more common, than what we have.
The thing is, every region thinks that they're unique in that.
That's what do you mean?
Problem. Well, I've heard that expression in Virginia. I've heard that expression in Georgia, in Indiana, in Hawaii, in New Zealand, in – well, okay, the west coast of Australia is more
like
here.
If – okay. It's fine. I don't know about this kind of science. It's totally true. It just seems like a very blanket statement to say. Earth is actually extremely volatile. It's really hard to know what kind of weather you have all the time.
We have a very moderate climate compared to
Miles'
a lot of other
point
places.
Is there is going to be some time where you might get stuck without an umbrella, and you have
granted,
to go.
That'll happen in California too. That just happens.
Yes, because you don't think it's ever going to rain. Anyways,
no, California, you have a lot of leeway most of the time.
So my point is that I, even though I'm in California, even though I know 7 days before it's going to rain, because that's the magic of California, Miles, I still have an umbrella in my car. It gets there, and if I need it, oh, wow, it's available.
And now you're assuming that the municipality that you live in is going to be car-based.
I'm assuming most people on the planet don't have cars, because you're going to tell me that now too. It's regional. Some places have cars. Some have public transportation.
I was actually thinking just within the U.S., major metropolitan areas. Most major metropolitan areas have some
and
sort of mass.
The majority of the population does not have cars. That's true. I get it. Fine. But they're close to their home or they're in public transportation.
This umbrella sharing thing is not going to happen out in the boonies. It's going to happen in a major metropolitan city.
Totally. Totally valid. And obviously they're needed because people keep them and put them in their homes.
Okay. On a side note, I did rent a bicycle in San Jose about a month ago.
Mm.
And I used the whole thing. I put my card in, got a gun number, I got the bike, and I put the bike back about a half an hour later. 3 days later, I was shocked to see on my bill that they had charged me the price for if I didn't bring the bike back. And I started frantically trying to figure it out. Did they think I didn't return it back to the device? Well, they have a delay, and then the credit card company has a delay. So that delay can be up to a total of 5 days. But for at least a day, I was convinced that they charged me $250 for a bike that I know I returned.
Ah.
So anyways, if the umbrella company decided to go that route, I think they could raise their deposit fee a bit.
That's right. Just delay paying money back. And then actually, you could actually charge them the same amount of money that's actually worth and just not give their money back for a month and use the interest of that. That's a devious business. If you
devious as in that's actually a viable market choice.
Sure.
Because if someone gives the umbrella back, then you don't keep that, you know.
Yeah, but if you keep the deposit for 10 days.
Well, I guess I think in terms
of – you make interest on the deposit.
This is very U.S.-centric or at least U.S. and Europe. I don't know
no,
about
no,
China
for
per se.
Planet,
but
dude. It's fine. You
stop.
Speak for the
that you can put a reserve hold on a credit card. So you're not actually charging it, but
right.
You can have that hold put onto it.
Sure.
And that doesn't actually charge you money. It just makes it so that you can't, you know,
sure.
Go to your credit limit.
But it's better to go ahead and charge the card, keep the money, and then reimburse them 7 days later.
Okay. That would be devious and evil. Yeah.
I'm Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak, and in the air with me, I have Miles Elam and Brian Young. And we're talking about technology, as we do. You can email us and give us feedback. Our email address is geeks@geekspeak.org.
I am honestly astounded that you don't really, like most places in the U.S. anyway. Like,
I think
just,
we covered
just
this.
In the U.S.
You said globally. You said on the planet.
But you should have
you
said in the habitable zone.
But you
know. You should have said the habitable zone.
No.
Where people inhabit the earth?
Storms come out of nowhere on the poles.
You enjoy making me wrong. It's awesome.
You were just fighting it so much. Like, I couldn't understand.
It just seems – my hackles get raised when people claim general knowledge about the planet.
He always has his hackles raised when he generalizes.
Yes, I always. Miles, you've got some updates on OpenBSD, your favorite operating system?
I have used OpenBSD before. It was usually painful. It does show up in appliances, like firewall appliances.
This is a Unix derivative.
It is. A BSD derivative, Berkeley Systems Distribution. The thing is, OpenBSD has not been known for having the newest utilities, hasn't been known for having the most bleeding-edge software. It tends to be very conservative. Tend to be very security oriented. In fact, whenever they do performance reviews, OpenBSD is always at the bottom of the list of the comparisons because their developers are saying we're going to be correct and secure first, and speed if you know as a secondary concern. Whereas many other vendors will say we're trying to make this fast, and we'll fix any security problems as they come.
Mm. Am I mistaken in saying that OS X Macintosh operating system is based off of BSD?
Not OpenBSD.
It's got a mock kernel, and it's got the user land utilities of BSD.
But that's it.
So it's not a BSD kernel.
No. Okay.
Not to my knowledge, anyway.
No. It's not
a mock kernel.
It is a mock kernel, yeah.
What does mock kernel mean?
It's a microkernel architecture that allows you to use, what do they call them? Not plugins. You can extend the kernel, which is unlike Linux, where you recompile the kernel with whatever you want to add to it.
Well, Linux is a monolithic model. Yes. As opposed to a microkernel-based, which is the idea your kernel is very small and you have services that talk to it.
So BSD, OpenBSD, and BSD and OpenBSD are microkernels, as is Macintosh's operating system.
No. BSD is also a fairly monolithic.
Oh, okay. So therefore there's a difference there.
Yeah. Microkernels are very niche. Like even the mock kernel is a hybrid model. It's not truly a microkernel in terms of the pure computer science definition of it. But the BSDs and Linux and Windows and like are anything but microkernel.
Okay, go on.
So security being of paramount concern for OpenBSD developers, they have added a new feature, which is that every time you update or reboot your kernel, it has been changed somewhat. The kernel signature changes.
Why?
When you are trying to target, for example, a Linux exploit, one of the ways you do that is you may look at the source code or play around with fuzzing and stuff like that to find a way into the system. And then you're able to target that particular version of the Linux kernel.
Because you find some kind of vulnerability.
Right. Okay. It's usually a common theme between all kernels that are on a particular distribution or a group of distributions.
So you find a vulnerability in the kernel.
And and the way you're able to exploit that is because each of them looks substantially similar to one another. This makes it so that every kernel – even by a reboot, even on a person's machine, if you reboot the machine, will have a slightly different profile.
There's an architecture in memory management or processor where that's similar to this, where you move memory around all the time.
Yeah, address space layout randomization.
Right.
But that
so this is a kernel level thing that's like this?
Yes.
So how does it rewrite the kernel? Is it putting the source code in different orders and why? How?
There you'd have to talk
read
to the
paper.
Yeah. So, because, I mean, this is something that I was unaware was even possible. And
well, I could imagine the compiler could do certain optimizations or not do optimizations, and the binary you get out of it would look different.
Right. But at the same time, this is talking about it's reordering stuff. Normally, when you're doing different optimizations, stuff is in the same order. You compile it twice. It always comes out the same output. Here they're talking about the linking and loading of files and libraries that are linked into the kernel get swapped around.
Interesting.
So you're not sure that it's going to be in the same order, or you're pretty much guaranteed it's not going to be in the same order. So address resolution, address space layout randomization, which you were talking about, randomizes the memory address within a particular application code. But this is doing a similar thing at the kernel level.
So the purpose of this is so that a malware can't fingerprint which version of this kernel it is and then target it?
And actually, I should say this isn't actually ASLR for the kernel. This is a linking difference.
Right. Okay.
Subtle but important difference. So what it's saying is that when you figure out an exploit, let's say you have a lockpicking tool and you figure out how to deal with a particular lock. And someone could go like, oh, well, these locks have been compromised. We're going to change all the locks. But once you figure out how to do it on one of them, if they've changed the locks to be all the same brand, you can unlock all of them. What this is saying is that every door is going to have a slightly different design to the lock. Your lockpick tool may not work and definitely can't be as easily automated as it is today.
Is it the signature of them or is it the actual implementation
of them? The actual implementation changes.
And this is done because on disk, it is different, or in memory running, it is different.
On disk, the blob gets altered.
The blob. So you have a binary you've compiled for a certain architecture, like a x86 or something, and you take that binary, and every time it opens and starts running, it modifies itself.
Yep.
That's weird. It's like an organism of some sort.
It is.
That's really cool.
And that is something that we're seeing with computers, is that we're having something that's more – things that are like an immune system.
The thing is, I don't get this, is if this application, which is the operating system, is actually running, when it's running, your code exploit is running inside it. So I mean, if you could rewrite the disk architecture or the stuff on the disk, you could do anything you want. So the whole point is that your application's in that – is running in the operating system. So why does it matter how the operating system is laid out on disk if in fact you're always penetrating it and dealing with it when it's in memory?
Okay. First off, the kernel can touch anything. That's one of the points behind a kernel.
I'm aware
of that. Doesn't have any limitations there. By changing the kernel around so that the layout of the binary is different each time means that malware can't get in the first place to compromise the system.
I guess what I'm saying is what I think of as a binary of a kernel is that it's on disk. It boots by running that application. When it does that, it takes all of that, I've always assumed, and puts it in RAM or runtime space, different levels of the thing. It being on disk at that point is insignificant. In fact, you could erase the file from the disk and you would still have a running operating system.
Once it's loaded, yes.
Once it's loaded. So therefore, once it's loaded and that's the target point of what you'd attack as a rogue application, an image processing thing or something like that that has a vulnerability, when I'm trying to run in that, I don't really care how it was saved to disk. I care about its signature in running memory space,
but
right?
But if the layout on disk affects the layout in memory,
which it does.
Okay. So it's effectively okay. So address space
randomization.
Randomization.
Layout randomization.
Thank you. There's only so many segments they can randomize there, and there have been exploits that are still able to defeat it because of that purpose. But if every time you load that kernel, you're loading it in a different configuration, different pattern, then that's infinitely more – well, not infinitely, but that's massively more random, I would think.
I see what you're saying. So every bit of – not just the start parts that it can randomize in memory, but all of it's randomized because when it's saved, it's randomized.
Well, there is a limit because you still have to have it work.
That's cool.
But yeah.
I just want to read one thing from you, and this is from a website I like to go to called Wikipedia.org. And that is the Mac OS X version history. Next step, which of course we all know is the basis of Mac OS X, next step was based on the mock kernel developed at CMU, which is Carnegie Mellon University, and BSD, an implementation of Unix dating back from the 1970s. So that's why I thought that it was based off of that. But it's partially based off of that. It's good to know. Thank you for that clarity. Shall we move on?
Yes.
A friend of mine is interviewing places. And doing – in fact, I also talked to Didi recently about this. Didi recently changed jobs and now works at Oracle. And in that process, had to do a whole bunch of technical recruiting, meaning she and this other friend of mine are interviewing at companies all the time and being asked all these questions. And one of the questions that seems to come up – and this comes up in almost all interviews – is referencing to Big O. I'm going to go ahead and play stupid here so we can try to explain this to everybody. But also talk about it a little bit. What is Big O notation, either of you?
So you really want to get geeky, eh?
Yeah. I like it sometimes.
The relative cost of an algorithm. So
what kind of cost? Memory cost or
when,
speed?
When dealing with a data structure, with a given data structure. So it's the a given data structure, how you're organizing the data combined with the algorithm for iterating through that data or getting the piece that you want.
Let's talk about this in metaphoric ways so that people can kind of understand this. Let's say that we are going to the grocery store and we want to find things in the grocery store. Is that a good basis for doing this kind of thing?
Sure. Because you're not going to just go through the entire store looking for eggs. You're going to look in a specific section of the store.
But let's say you've never been to the store before. You don't know where anything is. And there's rows in the store. And somewhere there's probably eggs. And you also have a list of the groceries that you want. And so you can kind of imagine that there's lots of ways you could tackle this problem. You could look for the first thing on your list and you could start walking the aisle from the very left and walking up and down until you find it. Mm-hmm. And then go back to the very beginning of the store. Look for the second item in the list and do that again. And we all know that that wouldn't be very efficient.
But for people who have really bad memories like me, it might work.
It also it might be necessary if like your shopping list is pasted on the outside on the car hood or something, where you have to go and look what the first item is and then go back in. So the way that I would walk to that grocery store to find the items I want, there's different algorithms to do that. And some of those would take me a long time and some of those would take me less time. And Big O notation tells me how much time it will take?
Big O typically refers to the worst case scenario.
And it doesn't tell you the time. It's not a formula for telling you a specific number of how long something will take.
I might walk slowly.
Well, yeah.
Or I might run.
But it's basically an algebraic notation that you can strip out all the extraneous things that don't actually help you figure out relative time and then be able to compare two algorithms by getting this highly reduced down function and just comparing one to another. Oh, this one can do it in logarithmic time and this one can do it in linear time.
So Big O gets bigger. If I say O of log n, mm-hmm. Is that better or is that faster or slower than in squared?
It's faster. Or it is much smaller.
Explain why.
So when they say log n, it's log 2 of n, binary, base 2. And logarithms were always something that gave me a hiccup when I was in Algebra 2.
Sure.
Like, what is a logarithm? And the way I finally got around to memorizing it was saying, for example, log 2 of 100. Log 2 100 equals. What that would mean is, what is the exponent of 2 that would give me 100?
Got it.
And then you figure out what that answer would be. Or actually, log 2 of 1024 would be a better case. So 1024 in this case is that thing that you're talking about, the O of n, the O of log n.
You lost me, Miles.
Okay.
Radio. Delicious.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for me to describe.
Like, it is, isn't it?
Traversing a binary tree is a log n operation, and yet
it's very hard to describe this.
Well, actually, here's a quick way of doing it.
Can you do it at the grocery store?
I was going to say, let's say you have 5 bricks on the ground.
Okay. We can all visualize that.
Yes. So how do you find out how many bricks you have?
You start at one side and you put your finger on it and you say 1, and then you move your finger to the next brick and say 2.
Right.
And so on to 5.
That is a O of n. In other words, n being the number of bricks. The amount of time it takes is proportional to the number of bricks there are.
So counting something is always n, O of n.
Yes.
It is the length tells you how long it's going to take you because
right.
there's nothing special you're doing
right.
to the bricks.
Right.
Okay.
Something that would be log n would be I'm dating myself here, but
can we do a simpler one than log n?
Well, okay, just imagine all those bricks are in a box.
Okay.
So to count them, you have to open the box and then you
have to take all of them out.
Put your finger on each one. So that's O of n. Well, what if on the outside of that box you had written that number? So it doesn't matter how many bricks are in that box. To find out how many are in that box, you just look at what's written on the outside
of the box.
So then
the O is just 1.
Yeah.
You just have to be the number.
Yeah, which is also referred to as constant time.
So all of these ways of thinking about how to order things, sort things, get around things, move things, shuffle things can all be described in this kind of mathematical
right.
thing called O.
Right. Big O being what is the typical or worst case scenario, and then little o being what's the best case scenario. But the best case scenario for a lot of algorithms tends to be unrealistic. It's not necessarily – if you get lucky, everything is really fast.
So I mean if for example, if you're sorting a whole bunch of stuff alphabetically, if it's already sorted alphabetically, that's going to be the bit small o. It's going to already be done.
It depends upon the algorithm. Some algorithms don't do very well with that. But
that's fantastic. Can we come up with a thing other than O of 1? And that, of course, would be that example of the box already having the number on it. The big O and the little o would be the same. It's always the same.
Right.
But the other one, the counting one is
how much fuel do you have in your car? You look at the gauge and it's always the same. But whether it's empty or full or somewhere in the middle,
unless you have a crappy car.
It takes the same amount of time to figure out how much gas is in the car.
Right.
That's an O of 1.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about something that's a little more complicated. Not log n, but let's talk about something else. Like, can you think
I found a log n. I have a really good example,
okay.
which is if you have – if you go to index cards, like say at the library.
Whoa! You think this example has any relevance to the people today?
For anyone over the age of 25,
just talk about it. Okay, your index cards.
So you're looking for something particular, and it's in alphabetical order. So if you want to find something that's in the P's, you're going to look in the middle of
does this deck have those little things that break out the alphabet letters, or is it just completely?
Let's say it's flat. It doesn't have any.
There's a whole bunch of index cards in a drawer, and alphabetically, there's all this grocery store stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the very beginning is like apples, or no, it's probably something before apples, but anyway,
sure,
anchovies, apples, and so on. So you have all these cards. So what you're saying is, if I'm looking for potato chips, they're in the P's.
Right. You're not going to start at the beginning, and you're not going to start at the end. You're going to start in the middle because that's around the middle of the alphabet. It's around the middle of the card deck if it's sorted.
If I were to start in the beginning, and let's say we have 1,000 cards,
mm-hmm.
that's the in, right?
Yes.
Okay. And I want to find one of those things, and it's alphabetically ordered, and I start at the very beginning. The big O would be 1,000? And
yes.
The small O would be...
The N would be 1,000, yes. It would be O of N, and N would be 1,000.
Okay. And the small O would always be, you could find it the first time with this algorithm. Could be in the beginning.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we're going to get better than that. We want to get better than O of N.
Right. And so we're going to start in the middle. And then if we don't hit it, if you're looking for a P, you'd see how far off am I from that letter and offset just a little bit. It's what we do all the time with sorted cards.
So you grab it in the middle and you see that you've got an N.
Yes. And so you jump a little bit. Just a little bit further, and you see, oh, now I'm in O's, jump that same little bit. Now I'm in P's, is it before or after? And you start making smaller and smaller jumps.
So what's that algorithm?
That is a log N.
Why?
Because you're splitting the problem each time.
Every time you check, you kind of check in the middle of what you think.
Yes.
And therefore, it's half and half and half, and that's logarithmic.
Yes.
Very cool. What would be, in that situation, N squared, which is worse?
N squared that can come into the case sometimes with you have a bunch of cards and you need to sort them.
Okay, you're not finding one item. You have to sort them.
Right.
So sorting, of course, is a harder problem because you basically have to keep finding the item that you need or something of that nature.
Right.
So what in that situation, these cards are now shuffled and you need to order them in order alphabetically.
Yeah. Or think
How
of
would
it,
you do that?
Or think of it – there are a couple ways of doing it. One is – you go through if the card is
you pick up each card
is in the wrong order, you put it there. Or if you if you're going through and you say, oh, this is now out of order, I have another card that it should be in front of, then you go back and find the exact spot it's supposed to be and you insert it into that spot. That's insertion sort.
Okay, so what it is that you look at the first two cards and you go, well, let me order these ones. You order them. Then you took the third card and you either put it in front of the first two, behind the first two, or in between the first two. So every time you get a card, you have to find the exact location.
Yes.
And that's called an insertion sort because you're inserting the item that hasn't been sorted into it. And right. It's kind of a dense process, right?
It's really useful if you only have a few cards.
What's the insertion sort O? Big O of insertion sort. Do you know?
I believe it's N squared.
N squared?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. I think we've beat this down well enough. The question I have for you is, I have never in my time as an engineer been asked to use Big O in an interviewing process. Have I just been extremely lucky?
I think you've been lucky, and I think you've been interviewing for a particular job skill set.
A user interface engineer.
Yeah.
Yeah, where I'm dealing with – I normally don't rewrite my own algorithms. How often have
you
–
Well, sure you do.
Well,
everything that you write has an algorithmic complexity.
Definitely. Let me say it this way. I rarely have large data sets I have to deal with. Because normally I'm dealing with interfaces already that have given me a good, clean way of doing that. Mm-hmm. So for example, though I don't do a lot of writing of indexes for database systems, I use indexes in database systems all the time. So there's like a level of knowledge I need. I mean, the thing is, of course, I understand this stuff well enough.
A lot of stuff know this on an intuitive level. So they don't know it in the formal computer science realm, and that's
true.
And that's fine, and that's how.
So the question I have, though, is I do know it intuitively. I also know Big O pretty well. But the other aspect of this is that I've never been asked an interview process. And that doesn't necessarily mean that I don't need to have the skill. But the question I have for you is, how often in your job as a software engineer, and both of you can answer this, and I'll try to answer it as well, have the ability to understand the annotation of a bubble sort been important in your job?
I don't know that that's the correct question. It's kind of like asking someone, how often have you used algebra since you got out of high school?
Well, most of the time they won't recognize that.
Right. A lot of people have. They've just done it intuitively because they had $20 and they needed to figure out how much chips and guacamole, ingredients they could buy without $20. And so you're doing algebra. Algebra is the way to be literate with the math that we already do.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel big O notation is the same way. It's a way of writing down and analyzing the algorithms that we already do intuitively.
I guess
in many cases,
the reason I ask this is from my understanding of technical interviews in Silicon Valley. What is asked in the interview process is almost in no relation to what the job actually is, and the other biases that exist when you interview somebody over dominates the actual skill set the person might have. I don't have a lot of faith in the technical interview process.
That's fair. No, that's absolutely fair because we've found through various studies that whiteboarding doesn't work, and a lot of times it ends up being kind of a crapshoot.
When you hired me at Feed the Monster 20 years ago, mm-hmm. did you know that – like did you think that I needed a certain amount of skill set and didn't have it? Did you – what was the thought process in that hiring process? Or at Google when you're hiring somebody, what's the thought process there? I want this person to be as good at the interviewing process as everybody else here, or I want this person to be a good engineer? Because it seems we're doing the former rather than the latter.
I want someone – if I'm looking to hire someone, I'm looking for them to be able to figure out the components of a problem. If I pose them a problem that needs some puzzle, that they're able to talk through it and figure out what needs to – what are its component pieces and how to approach it. And if they can describe to me a situation where they've had to deal with something like that.
Okay.
So if somebody could describe that, well, if we did it this way, that'd be inherently a lot slower than if we did this adjustment here and did it this way. They had no vocabulary for math and algebra, but they had this understanding of what's faster and what's slower and why it's that way. Would that be equivalent?
That'd be fine with me. If someone didn't know the terms Big O notation or said they didn't know the Gang of Four design patterns for object-oriented programming – that means less to me than – because those are things that we have a word for them. We have terminology for that. But you can ask someone, so why wouldn't you do this and describe it in code? Why
if they have a good answer to that question, then they intuitively understand it just like I understand how to do
If I have a stack of information and I need to find the thing – I need to find one particular item in there – what do I need to know? What do I need to do? And them answering that question doesn't require them to use the terms Big O and doesn't require them to use those terms.
When you were hiring people at Google or other companies that you've hired for miles, did you have an idea of a question you're going to ask them first, or is this a written thing that already existed? Or did you create a question?
No, I had ideas
for questions.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to do a little – We've got a few more minutes left on this episode, and I want you to start an interview process, and you're going to interview Brian. Go ahead. I want to hear what this kind of thing is, and then
I haven't prepped this time.
Have them in your back of your mind. Think of one.
I haven't done this in – okay.
It's okay. I'll pretend to be really nervous.
Don't do that. Go ahead. We're judging Miles here. Go ahead, Miles. Go ahead and ask away.
So the questions I ask of Brian are going to be things that are based more in the graphical realm, but also coding based. So something I might ask just to get the lay of the land might be, so are you familiar with RGB color notation? Like the
– what? Yes, what the color space is
when
you talk about RGB.
Yeah, pound sign followed by a bunch of hexadecimal numbers.
Okay. Yes, I'm familiar with that. So what is it that you're asking for me to demonstrate that knowledge?
So why do we use hexadecimal numbers for them?
Ooh. Now, this is funny for domain space. I know this from computer graphics. I know about color space from computer graphics. I don't know it from web technologies, which is I know where you're coming from. I actually don't know why hexadecimal is used, but I can guess it's probably has to do with the space that takes up memory space. No. I don't know.
Yeah, and this will be an example of why techno interviews sometimes fall flat, because I know that he is technically competent.
Whereas I could talk to you about why we use 256 as a number to represent color, or 0 to 1 for maybe if you've got 16-bit memory space, you could represent quite a good image in 0 to 1 with 16-bit space.
So to be clear, in the web world, the way I first saw this was when we started dealing with CSS for layout and web, and we were specifying the color, the RGB values of color on the screen. And RGB, of course, is red, green, blue, and it's the pixel, the light that emits on the LCD. And when CSS emerged, you could produce, as you said, 0 to 255 of each of those colors, and how much you put in there is how much color you had. So if you had a 100% red or 255 red and then 0 of the other two, you'd have a red screen. Why it's actually a hexadecimal, is that the question you're asking?
Yeah. The reason why I ask that question is I want to – it tells me how long someone's been working with it, how much they took it for granted, how much they tried alternatives.
Like what kind of alternatives?
Well, did you use 0 to 255? There is an RGB syntax, for example, in CSS. Did you say RGB and then 255, 255, 255?
Sure, you can do that.
To give white instead of pound FFFFFF.
Which is also white.
Hexadecimal is useful because it can be represented in two characters for an 8-bit value. Each letter refers to 4 bits, whereas if you have 0 to 255 – you could allocate to say, oh, it's going to be 3 characters all the time, but most of the time you would be under 100.
You're kind of wasting that, if you will.
Right. And there's nothing stopping you from going to 256 if you give 3 digits available in that spot. So if you use FF, you're mapping to
exactly the range.
You're basically at an in-between point, a halfway compromise between how a computer is dealing with that data and how a human being can interact with that data. We don't deal well with binary. We don't deal well with 0101010101, but a computer doesn't deal with decimal very well. 10 isn't a power of 2.
I don't think that's a very good question.
Yeah,
get anywhere. I mean, it's,
but all of them are going to be a matter of what is your domain knowledge and can you figure out how to talk about this stuff.
And how I brought that up was saying that technical interviews are fraught, and I was trying to make it clear. I wasn't going to use that as, oh, you don't know that? Well, you're obviously stupid. And I wanted to get a gauge of like where they lived. What have they thought about it? If they think about things in terms of the graphics and getting that part down, they may not know that technical level, or if they have a more analytic side, in which case they may have noticed it and may have spent a bunch of time converting from decimal to hexadecimal and seen that advantage. For me, it was trying to get a sense of the person, where they were at.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to do in the space of a 30-minute interview.
Would you say technical interviews show you whether somebody is qualified, but they don't show you if someone is unqualified? In other words, they pass the test, you feel like you've got a good idea. But if they don't pass the test, it's just an unknown.
A better way to conduct an interview and something that I should have done instead of – because this asking questions, it is a crapshoot like that. What you should do, or at least what I think you should do more often, is ask the person, what is something that you've worked on that was technically complex that you were proud of? Because that gives you an in about what the person is interested in. What they feel is a technical, or a complex problem, how they came about – you can do follow-up questions, how they came about the solution, what were they thinking about with it, or can they think of any other way that they would have solved that problem? Do they think that it was the optimum way to solve that problem? If not, why did they choose that solution over another one? It opens up for a bigger conversation. and seeing how that person thinks.
Hmm. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence, is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we made it. Today's show is called Typos Force Arbitration of Big O Notation. And this, of course, is episode 25 of season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air remote today, and thank you very much, both of you gentlemen, Brian Young and Miles Elam.
Always a pleasure.
See you next week.
Let me ask you, answer the question to why, I don't feel like you answered well enough why we use hexadecimal notation for colors. I don't feel like that was answered well, because the 0 to 255 is completely arbitrary.
It's not completely arbitrary.
No, the
it's
reason,
an 8-bit value.
Well, yeah, but the reason why we're doing 8-bit value is because screens could do 8 bits at that point.
No.
No?
No.
Well, what do you think? Why are we using 8-bit value?
Because 8 is a power of 2, and it worked out to be a good enough color palette.
So you're saying that we're doing that because one character would be too small, and three characters would be too big.
Two colors is black and white.
Yes.
It's a monochrome.
Sure.
Without any type of shading, not grayscale. You know, 2 to the 2nd, you know, 2 bits, 4 colors. That ends up being very strident colors or shades of gray.
Sure.
You know, white and 2 shades of gray.
Go on.
And so you're going to add – because you want to do this in terms of bits for a computer – to handle, you're going to keep adding on until you get to a reasonable number. It's the same reason why.
So if you went one power larger, it would be unreasonable. We wouldn't have that much granularity because, and I would argue, the reason is at the time that much granularity didn't make sense. At the time now, that much granularity does make sense. I mean, it's about the output forms that you're trying to target.
Let's talk about how. Yes, but let's talk about why we standardized on 8 bits to a byte, because that really ties into it.
That's, sure.
We didn't do a thing of 64 characters because we're going to be going off the powers of 2, you know, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512. So why didn't we stop at 64? Well, if you're thinking in the American or English alphabet, which is where a lot of these standards were developed, you're talking about, okay, you have 26 letters,
but uppercase and lowercase,
uppercase and lowercase, which means you're now at 52.
And now you need some
and
numbers.
Then 0 through 9.
And now you need punctuation.
Exactly.
It's above
so
64.
Now you've pushed over 164. And now you get to 128, which is what ASCII was, a 7-bit integer. But 7 bits is hard to navigate sometimes because it's not 7 is not a power of 2. 8 is. And so that was the smallest number that could handle the general case.
Right. So that pattern, though, is assuming beforehand that the amount you want to encode can fit in there. And when we're dealing with color, 2-character hexadecimal 3 times does not produce all the color gamut we now can do. So it was about the color that could be produced at the time, right?
The color amount, like the fact that you used 8 bits for the colors was in a direct response to standardization of 8 bits to a byte.
Oh, I see. Once you have 8 bits to a byte, then if you start looking at that,
everything else starts becoming
right.
You're dealing with that as a basic building block. Now,
okay.
There have been processors that have really strange, you have like 14-bit bytes, you have 34-bit bytes. Those exist, but they've fallen by the wayside. Nowadays, when we talk about a byte, it's 8 bits. 8 bits to a byte.
Right.
You know, 16 bits to a word.
So for user interface kind of – you said you were hiring this conceptual Brian for graphics knowledge, so user interface knowledge. Do you think that understanding is useful to have for, I don't know, a web developer who's doing like maybe JavaScript and such?
User interface can mean so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was trying to narrow it down to figure out – that was a step in the notion. Like where do you stand with them? What do you see with that?
So –
but you're using that as a stand-in to see if the candidate has a deeper knowledge.
Right. And I also said it was flawed.
Yeah.
I think we all agree that the technical interview process is flawed. I think all of us agree that. But the fascinating thing is this has to occur, right? This is happening still. And all the studies say that it's not a very good way to do this. And the prejudice actually comes up as the highest ranking mm-hmm. motivator for taking people on. So
when you say the prejudice, what do you mean?
Just the general perspective of how the person gets along with the other person. That's what wins. So if someone comes in and someone else comes in to do the interview and they talk about all this technical crap and all this ASCII character, you know, whatever they're talking about, the truth is if the person that's interviewing the person that's being interviewed likes them, they'll hire them. That's what it's about. It's about liking each other.
Well, also if
and not
they
being incompetent.
Are like them.
And like them. Well, that's the thing is why do people like – you know, what do people like? Well, they like things that are familiar. There's all these
exactly.
things.
Yeah.
And so if you have someone who has a completely different cultural background or speaks in stuff a totally different way, then they're just not going to bond that way. The problem I have with it all, and I think all of us have, is that this technical interview is masking what's actually happening in this way of then being able to justify it later. And I just find it
– I don't know if it's masking, but it is definitely affecting. It is introducing a non-trivial
game.
Amount of bias.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So I think you're right, though, that – asking a person to share their expertise in a way about something they're comfortable with is nice if the person's a storyteller. You know, because if the person doesn't like to talk about what they do in detailed ways and share how they're thinking and stuff, they're not going to do good in the interview, right?
And I guess the rationale there is if they can't do that in the interview, they can't do that working with their colleagues.
Right. So that's the real question is like, what is it that they that's kind of where I'd love to think about how the process should go. It should be more like what the everyday job actually is. That's why the take-home test or the idea of like, please develop this thing and then come in and show us is such a great starting point. We do that here. At the same time, it's hard to judge whether it's highly effective. And it's also a big time sink, right? If someone's interviewing at 10 companies and each of them asks for 10, you know, a two-day development process, that's a lot of development mm-hmm. that doesn't do anything. What do you think about the take-home?
In general, I think it's a good idea as long as it's relevant to the job they're going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, okay, you have a task and it's going to be relevant. It's going to be the type of thing that you would be doing at the job. I worry about some companies that use that as an excuse to, hey, here's something that we need to get done. Here's an example. And then they do it and it's like, okay, thanks for that. We're going to check that in.
No, yeah, that's immoral or unethical.
It happens.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the take-home, Brian?
Oh, I'm not familiar with the take-home interview task. I mean, I've been a part of interviews where they have a test during the interview process.
During the interview. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
so, so you're talking about a half an hour, 45 minutes. Maybe you get a few hours to work on it.
Right.
And those are really interesting because what you can do in that time is not what you would do with production code.
Mm-hmm. And it also comes into play of the people who are really nervous in interviews, you know, people who are shy introverts may freeze up. You know, something they've done on that type of task many times, but their brain has frozen up because there's one wrinkle to it that
right.
combined with their nervousness
I don't think I'll talk about what we actually do now at Netflix when we're hiring people in different groups because I'm not sure how much we want to share that prior outside. But I can tell you that like 3 years ago or 4 years ago when I was interviewed here, I was given a take home and it was a you guys know what the Netflix interface looks like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So this was recreating that Netflix interface that actually exists on an iPhone in a browser. And here is the data set. And I think the data set was actually using like a big JSON graph of like movie data from IMDb or something. It was mm-hmm. like a big thing with a whole bunch of images, references. And basically it was like make rows of images that you can scroll through. And I had 2 days to do that and brought that in. And didn't feel like I did a good job of it, you know. And then the interview process, a big part of the interview process was talking about what I had done and why I did it. And I think that was a pretty good way of getting, you know, mm-hmm. ideas of how I think and how I develop. There was no other rules about it. Like, here's a JSON file. Make it work on the web, right? And so they were asking things like, hey, this doesn't actually work when you rotate it. Why'd you do that? And I said, well, I didn't feel like when it rotated it, changing shape made sense. But I also didn't know the API to lock it down on iOS. I didn't look it up. So I know there is an interface for that. I just didn't do it. So it could rotate, but it looked bad, you know? So assuming that I spent the extra time to lock that down, that's how it was meant to be. And they're like, okay, that makes sense. So like there was this very mm-hmm. much this like honesty aspect of like, this is what happened. Another aspect is someone said to me, who's actually now a good friend of mine, said you don't have a manager plan for when you want to open multiple of these videos at once, you know, like these display pages at once. You don't have something that's managing that. You dismiss it and open another one. What if I want to open a lot? I said, well, I put in an area here that this is where I would put it, and I knew that it was needed, and I have a comment in there that says, you know, in future there'll be some controller that handles this. But since I didn't need it at the time, I didn't implement it. And they actually later on, I found that they were like, well, Lyle's okay. He's not going to be a good architect here, but he's, you know, they made that assumption. Of course, since then I've done a lot of architecture stuff. So it's completely luck, I feel. And at the same time, personality,
yeah,
more than anything else.
And we wonder why Silicon Valley has a cultural problem with diversity.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I have come across folks that have said, hire the person. You can train the person, but you can't train the personality, like how well they can get along with folks and communicate.
You know, we have a public culture deck and actually another file that kind of talks about how things mm-hmm. work here. And a big part of that is being able to communicate well and not have a lot of hangups and no drama. There's not a lot of drama here. There's like no anger / frustration among people at this company at all, right?
That you've seen.
That I've seen. But I mean, it's kind of like I've, you know, had issues with people, and then we go down and sit down and work it through. And it's a maturity level that I've had a lot of other companies where that didn't exist.
Sure.
But I think in Silicon Valley, that kind of stuff does exist. I think that in general, it's pretty common to have really high egotistical people in control of large groups of people deciding what is going on, and people beneath them going, ugh.
Well, that in startup culture is a lot of times in survival mode.
Yes, that's true.
And whenever you put people in a persistent state of stress and in strong competition with one another, some bad behaviors can bubble to the surface while you're trying to get stuff done. Yeah, what do you do when your top coder is also an ass?
You know, like, you fire him.
Yeah, and that's what you should do. And there's a lot of companies that don't do that because they're worried about, like, well, they're the only one who knows how our product works, which is already a failure that you've gotten to that point. But there's that back and forth, because that was a lot of what I heard about from some of the culture within Uber was you have these high performers and therefore they get a pass on being a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, coming back to the very beginning of this discussion, insertion sort, O and log N.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wrong.
Very important skill for anybody.
I do know
Can
that
you
I would,
say that
I,
again, please?
I do know that I would much rather have a quick sort for large data sets than I would an insertion sort, but okay.
Which one's quick sort?
Quick sort is a divide and conquer algorithm. You're oftentimes doing it as a recursive algorithm, but you're splitting the data set in half and then splitting in half and splitting in half at a pivot point and sorting from there and then bubbling it back up again when the application or when the function returns.
You know, I'm actually questioning my source. I have a feeling this one might be wrong.
I remember seeing a great presentation about sorting algorithms, and two of them that are normally called as different algorithms are actually the same algorithm. I can't recall which ones it was.
Was one of them bubble sort?
I don't recall.
Yeah, insertion sort is N squared.
Okay, yeah. As I was looking through this, it looks like my source is wrong. Okay, thank you.
So I once asked an interviewee, please give a data model for a Rubik's Cube game.
Mm-hmm.
And I only did that once because I'd heard of it as an idea, and I know Rubik's Cube pretty well. And it is extremely unfair thing to do to somebody because
people do their undergraduate theses on Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, they're complicated. I mean, this wasn't a solving algorithm. It wasn't about solving. It was just about data modeling. Just give me a data structure that can store a Rubik's Cube and move a Rubik's Cube, you know, move from any position to another position with a one move. Now, for you to understand how that model has to work, you have to perfectly understand how a Rubik's Cube can move, first off, right? Mm-hmm. And if you haven't played with Rubik's Cubes a lot, you don't know how they move.
Right.
So it's completely a cultural bias, right?
Yep.
I mean, people that have used Rubik's Cubes as much as I have can actually start tackling that problem.
Which is why you asked the question, because it was something that was intimately familiar to you.
But as the person was going through it, as soon as they started answering the question, I realized they don't even know how a Rubik's Cube actually moves. So I stopped and said, oh, this is how Rubik's – I didn't have one with me, unfortunately. But then I had to stop them and say, you know what? I'm sorry. This is how they move, and conceptualize it this way, please. But what did come out of it was that they definitely went through a process with me of communicating how they were thinking, and it did achieve that, but only because I kept on repairing the mistake I had made. I wish I remember who I gave that test to, because maybe we hired them, and I don't know if we did or not. I should ask my colleagues who, if I ever gave that test to them.
So in the end, you were offering them information throughout it that was maybe more than you would have done if there was a different kind of problem?
Yeah, I think so. I think I was kind of like, oh, I've thought of this problem before. Think about, you know, this can happen. What would you do there? I don't actually have – I mean, even though I've asked this question, I've studied it and thought about it and stuff and even kind of started mocking it, I don't feel like I have a good handle on the best way to do it.
The data model?
Yeah, and I think that's a really great way to actually come from, because you don't want to know the right way so that when you ask the question, the person might answer it wrong. Like if they're thinking about it and answering it by thinking about it and going forward, that's actually correct. Coming to your conclusion is not what you want them to do. You actually want them to think differently than you. That's why they should be a teammate of yours. So there's that aspect. Okay, how does merge start work?
Basically, you break it all down into individual bits, and then you just start building it up. So you take two bits, compare them, order them. Take another two, compare them, order them. Take those combined.
Well, sets of data is actually, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not using the correct term. I'm sorry. But it's breaking the problem down in the smallest possible instances and building up. And so each time you're combining two pre-sorted arrays into the next larger array.
I see.
And the fact that they're pre-sorted gives it...
Helps them in adding them together.
That's where you get the efficiency. Yeah.
That's what the merge is part.
Yeah.
You merge this.
But they must create different sort algorithms. Like, for example, insertion sort is, even though it's O n squared, you don't need more... You don't need to allocate new memory for a new array to sort the items. You can sort it in place.
Right. So sometimes you're not just talking about the speed of sorting. They're talking about how much memory you're using in order to achieve that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So a merge sort uses twice as much memory.
Yeah. And
twice as much memory as what? Insertion?
As quick sort.
This is why the default implementation of JavaScript sort gives back a new array. It doesn't sort the actual array you're passing in.
Nice. See, that'd be a good question. Right to JavaScript. Why does the sort give a new array?
But that's arcana. Like why? I don't know that that's that. Well, that again is a bias.
Wait,
of,
that's arcana.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, the color thing is arcana. I mean, come on,
It is.
Okay. I mean, there's knowledge and there's reasoning, and so much of programming requires some body of knowledge that is different from somebody else's body of knowledge.
Right, and this is why I was saying my question was bad, and this is why I thought it was better to ask someone, "What are you?"
Yeah.
What is something that strikes out for you in your career that you did?
Because your goal is to find out their reasoning abilities.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. What their strengths are, what their reasoning skills are, like, you know, to get them to talk about it. Because if someone has something that they've worked on, then it's a lot easier for them to go into the details about it, the rationales for it, to answer questions about it. And so it's on you, the interviewer, to pull that out of them as opposed to just give random arbitrary questions, which I sadly have done in the past, given these questions that seemed important to me, but it was because that's what makes me rather than what makes you, you.